Hello and welcome to the Spectators Podcast. I'm Kate Andrews. Last month, the government released its 10-point plan for what it dubs the Green Industrial Revolution. At the top of the list was offshore wind, pledging to produce enough power for every home by 2030. Offshore wind currently constitutes over 50% of renewable energy produced in the UK, with costs coming down considerably in a matter of years. But does offshore wind have its limits? Is it always a good deal for the consumer? And how far can it realistically advance us on our road to net zero carbon emissions by 2050? To discuss all this and more, I'm joined by Kwasi Kwarteng MP, Minister for Business, Energy and Clean Growth, Benj Sykes, VP for UK Offshore at Ørsted, and Sir David King, the former Chief Scientific Advisor to the UK government. This podcast is kindly sponsored by Ørsted. So Kwasi, let's start with you. The government has said it wants to make the UK the Saudi Arabia of wind. What exactly does that entail in practice?
So if we look at where we are now, we have something like 10 gigawatts, a bit more, of offshore wind capacity. And that represents something like 35% of the globally installed capacity. So Britain is a world leader in this. And the first point of the Prime Minister's 10-point plan was all about offshore wind. And we've essentially increased our ambition to 40 gigawatts of capacity by 2030. So that's less than 10 years now. And we want to essentially nearly quadruple the amount of capacity that we have in offshore wind. And that's practically the headline of what we're trying to do. And we could talk about how we can do this through the CFD round, Contracts for Difference, how we've managed to reduce the price, the cost of offshore wind power over the last 8 years, and the kind of ambitious trajectory that we want to plot over the next 10 years.
Benj, where does Ørsted fit into this ambition? Talk us through what the company is trying to do.
Sure. Thanks, Kate. So as the largest offshore wind developer globally, but also in the UK, we've already got 12 wind farms operating. We're very much focused on scaling up offshore wind in the UK. We're currently building Hornsea 2, which is going to be the world's largest offshore wind farm, 1.4 gigawatts, enough for 1.3 million homes to be powered. And so what we want to do is to accelerate the build out of offshore wind, working with Kwasi and his team in Bays, but also working with important stakeholders right across the piece. DEFRA, of course, very important from an environment perspective, Ofgem and others, so that we can drive the yearly deployment of offshore wind up and hit that 40 gigawatt target. It is achievable if we work together.
We'll come back to these wind farms and the practicalities and the costs. But first, Sir David, what do you make of the government's pledge on wind power to be producing enough electricity to power every home by 2030? Is it going to be possible?
I think it's not only possible, I think it's necessary, and I very much welcome the Prime Minister's commitment on this. I think what we need, of course, to see is that there is a systemic approach to providing our energy systems out to 2030. And this means looking very carefully at the role of hydrogen. It means looking very carefully at the role of small modular nuclear reactors, for example, that Rolls-Royce is now ready and willing to produce for the UK market and abroad. It means also looking at how we store energy generally. And one of the most important things is as we roll out electric vehicles, we see that battery charging of those electric vehicles occurs whenever possible during those hours in the night when there's very little demand for electricity and when electricity is cheap. And this means, quite simply, intelligent chargers for cars. In that way, in other words, we can switch over from using petrol on roads to using electricity without a massive increase in electricity demand overall. So in other words, the grid itself becomes balanced using the charges in the electric vehicles. So I think it's a wonderful way forward, and I applaud the government's decision to push on this effort. And of course, what it means is that we can anticipate the same happening in many other countries as well.
Sir David, as you mentioned, there are other forms of energy. You've said in the past that nuclear would be a more reliable, more affordable way forward. Do you still think that? What role does wind power have in this?
Right. So I have to say that you're referring back to 2003, 2004, when I made that statement. And of course, things have moved along. If we now look at where wind power is, offshore wind, the price has come down a factor of three or more just over the last 5 or 6 years. And so now wind turbines offshore are now really competitive with any other form of energy in the marketplace. The most expensive part of the agenda going forward is nuclear. And everyone knows that. Nuclear up at £90 per megawatt hour, roughly speaking, and wind up between £40 and £60 per megawatt hour, offshore wind. So we are looking at something that's more expensive, but I do think the advantage of nuclear on the grid is that it provides that stable electricity supply right through the year, the winter months as well, when clearly the intermittency of wind, but also solar, means that we may well depend on having such a supply on the grid.
And Kwasi, to stay on this point of other forms of energy, how does the UK's wind power ambition fit in with other sources of energy? What is the broader picture?
As Energy Minister, in terms of policy, you've got to take a holistic approach. There are lots of different technologies that we will need ahead of 2050. And the way that I put it is that we must get away from this idea that it's somehow a tennis tournament, and that all these technologies are pitted against each other and there'll be one winner at the end. In fact, if we want a resilient system, we need a diversity of supply. I think renewables are very important in that. I think, as Sir David said, I think nuclear has a role to play, and also different types of renewables. You've got offshore wind, you've got some onshore wind, you've got solar. We're investigating the possibilities of marine energy in the form of tidal power. There'll be floating offshore wind. So there are lots of different sources of energy. And I think in order to get to a decarbonised future, we're going to have to look at a wide range of technologies.
Kwasi, in the marketplace, in theory, the best, most advanced technology can win. But when we're talking about subsidies, money allocated by the government, there are inevitably winners and losers in those handouts. The last round of Contracts for Difference in 2018, a scheme that you have championed, saw over £500 million in subsidies be advocated. So, you know, it's great to say that all of these different forms of energy will have a role to play, but really some are going to be more favored by government going forward on our pathway to net zero by 2050. What forms of energy are going to be more favoured when it comes to money?
So the thing I would say about that is that the clue's in the title, net zero. Anything that's carbon emitting is unlikely to be favoured. But across the range of renewables, there are, through CFD auctions, you're quite right, the price is supported in some instances. But we've got hydrogen potentially on stream. We've got renewables in the form of renewable wind, offshore and onshore. We've got solar energy potentially on stream. We're looking at marine energy. There's a considerable lobby that's very interested in tidal power. So there's a whole, I've just listed four or five different technologies, which I'm sure will be part of the energy mix. And of course, there's nuclear as well. So that's about six technologies that I've mentioned that are part of the energy mix. And you're quite right to say that in some instances, there is government support for them because they chime in with our decarbonisation agenda. But as Sir David said, I mean, the price fall or reduction in offshore wind is incredibly encouraging. And we're coming to a point where a lot of these technologies don't need the kind of support that you've mentioned.
Benj, wind power in the UK has two reputations. One is a success story, a world leader, as Kwasi called it earlier in the podcast. It has defied many expectations on energy delivery, on price point. But the other is a reputation for being unreliable, that it's intermittent. Is this a fair analysis?
So there's no getting away from the fact that renewables like wind power and solar are non-dispatchable. So as Kwasi has said, and Sir David has said, we need a mixture of technologies to ensure a resilient as well as a low cost and low carbon grid. I would want to come back though to the point Sir David made around this isn't just about different forms of power generation. It's also about how you run the system. It's about smart charging of 1 million electric vehicles. That's a huge battery right across the country. And I know BEIS is already working on that policy suite that will enable all of our cars to not only take power from the grid, but to put it back when prices are high. So you've got demand side response. There's a whole toolkit that's being developed. Offshore wind, though, I think it's beyond doubt now that offshore wind is going to be the backbone of our power system in Britain. The prices are already well below the BEIS's own forward price forecast out into the 2030s and beyond. And we know that prices will continue to be pushed downwards through the competitive CFD auctions, the next one coming up later next year. So offshore wind has a crucial central role to play. And the other thing is hydrogen. It's been mentioned once already. Hydrogen has the opportunity not only to decarbonize other parts of our energy use across industry, across transport, across a whole domestic heating, for example, but it also means we can put more offshore wind on the system and deal with that variability of the wind and make sure that we have a resilient, low-cost system.
Sir David, intermittency is still a problem, though, isn't it? And at the moment, the taxpayers making up those costs, not the wind energy companies themselves. Is that the right balance between public sector money, taxpayer money, and the private sector?
I think the question of who pays is almost a moot point. I think, in other words, in the end, we, the taxpayer, pay whether we're using the electricity or whether we're paying our taxes. So for me, that is a matter of detail, and I wouldn't want to go into that. But I do think, and clearly Kwasi has already said this, that you've got to have a balance of different forms of energy onto the grid to manage overall the demand. And, you know, there are probably something like 3 days in the North Sea when, in the winter, the wind doesn't blow sufficiently to provide it all the electricity demand, which is much higher in the winter. And that is where, for example, nuclear comes into play. And if we have to pay more for nuclear, then we have to do that because a balanced grid is required. So I it's not as if we're managing to pay more than we should. It is only right that we have a secure energy supply at all times when we need it.
Kwasi, let me pick up this question about costs with you, because the customer might say, I'm paying my energy bills as I'm supposed to do, I'm paying my taxes as I'm supposed to do, but it looks like I'm going to be asked more and more, and it's starting to add up to be quite a bit. Do you think we have the right balance between the public and the private sector here? And whether it's intermittency or constructions on wind farms, it's clear that the taxpayer is supporting the industry quite a lot.
So I think your point would have more force if we'd seen an increase in wholesale energy prices, but of course we haven't. Broadly, I think the energy consumer is in a much better place today in 2020 than was the case 10 years ago. And I think that increasing supply, increasing sources of supply, actually in the long run will benefit the consumer, on top of obviously the climate change effects as well. So I see it as an opportunity. I also feel, along with Sir David, that ultimately, even if the producers of electricity are charged, they will pass a lot of those costs through to the consumer anyway. So as a society, as a whole, we are broadly paying for this, either as taxpayers or as consumers paying energy bills to companies.
I suppose the point, Kwasi, is that many people fall into both categories. They are both taxpayers and they're paying their bills. So perhaps I'll word it a slightly different way. Do you think the government is doing enough to sell the idea of the long-term benefits so people understand why these investments are being made now?
I think we could do a lot more in that. I think that, but having said that, I think there's been a huge change in the public's perception. I mean, I've fought 5 general elections as a candidate, and 2019 was really the first time that climate change issues, energy policy, really was raised on the doorstep more frequently than I had anticipated. And I think people are getting more aware of this issue of decarbonisation, particularly younger voters. I'd say people under the age of, let's say, 40, are particularly alive and engaged with this subject. And I think, but having said that, I think there's more to be done, definitely. I think we could get the message out more loudly and more clearly.
Benj, construction of Hornsea 1, an Ørsted wind farm, is predicted to cost the UK taxpayer £500 million per year in subsidies. I mean, those costs add up quite quickly.
So I think the first thing to talk about is where Hornsea 1 fits into the trajectory of this cost reduction that Sir David and Kwasi both mentioned. So Hornsea 1 was a project that was conceived about 9-10 years ago and was part of that journey that's driven the cost down. And we know that all technologies are more expensive at the start of that cost journey than at the end. And what we've seen is through the good, consistent policy framework that we've been able to operate in the UK, that's given the UK's leadership in offshore wind, we've been able to drive those costs down. And if you look at Hornsea 2, as I mentioned earlier, that is pretty much at wholesale prices, and the next crop of projects are well below wholesale prices. And that's what I think is making offshore wind such an attractive proposition for consumers, because it's driving the cost down. But of course, there's a lot more to what the offshore wind industry is going to deliver out to 2030, beyond the £50 billion of private sector investment that's going to come into the market to deliver that 40 gigawatts, the next 30 that's going to be built. You know, I'm working with Kwasi and others to make sure that we deliver that green recovery from COVID that is so important, bringing clean, green jobs across the UK. And we've already seen good progress on that. The industry's already reached almost 50% UK content, which after 10 years is pretty remarkable. If you look at older manufacturing industries like automotive, I think we've done an extremely good job, but there's a lot more to do. And I think right now, particularly as we talk about the green recovery as a context of the 10-point plan, it's absolutely vital that we work together to find the ways to bring a thriving, globally competitive supply chain to the UK that generates more economic activity, more jobs, more prosperity right across the country, not just in the southeast of England.
Kwasi, there have been some ideas put out there recommending that nuclear be used as the baseline for a renewable energy grid when solar and wind don't pull through. What might we expect to see in the upcoming energy white paper about the government's plans for a diversified approach to reaching the 2050 goal?
So I think the key part of the question, the phrase you used, was diversified approach. There's no silver bullet in terms of the challenge of net zero. There's no one technology that is going to take us all the way there. So we have a very diverse approach, as you say, and the energy white paper, I think, reflects that. Clearly, the Prime Minister's 10-point plan reflects it. I mean, the Prime Minister's 10-point plan had 10 points. All of them were different, you know, but it was headed off with offshore wind, I think, was the first point he made. The second was hydrogen. The third was nuclear. He talks also about carbon capture, which we haven't mentioned in this podcast. So again, there's a huge range of technologies. The Energy White Paper, I think, reflects that diversity, as did the Prime Minister's 10-point plan.
Benj, what about the use of batteries in wind power? There's a lot of talk about how batteries could fix some of the intermittency problems. Could they help? And how far has the tech advanced on that front?
So batteries, and I guess by that you mean lithium-ion batteries, rechargeable batteries, if you like, are an important technology, and that technology has progressed. And Ørsted's done a number of medium-scale battery projects, sort of megawatt-scale battery projects. I think it's really important to recognise that battery storage is not going to provide you with days and days of storage at a scale that you would need if you wanted to cover all of the periods of lower wind across the whole year. We'll be using other technologies. But one important thing, and I did mention it earlier, is batteries in cars. And you know, we know that cars are stationary more than 80% of their time, plugged into a smart grid with smart charging. You've got a huge capacity there to feed energy back into the grid when it's needed. But I think there are other ways in which we'll balance supply and demand. And of course, we've mentioned hydrogen. We don't yet know exactly how that is going to work. Is it going to be hydrogen going back into power? Is it going to be for fuel cell? We simply don't know exactly what that architecture is going to look like. We do know we need a mix of technologies, and I don't think anyone would argue against that. I mean, we can have our views on which technologies are going to be most important in supporting offshore wind, which, as I said before, will be the backbone. I think we have to wait and see. And I think it has to be the system level cost that drives the solution. We have to make sure that consumers are getting best value out of a low carbon electricity and energy system.
Kwasi, last question for you. Some of the government's critics say that this sort of green agenda is not what this Conservative government, with its red wall support, was voted in on. Are you at all worried that efforts to combine the levelling up agenda, the green agenda, and the COVID recovery will eventually fall through?
I don't think so at all. I actually think that the green agenda fits very well with the levelling up agenda. And I stress this all the time. If you look at where a lot of the energy investment is taking place, a lot of it is taking place, most of it, I would say, in our old industrial heartland. So when you talk about carbon capture, we're talking about Humber, we're talking about Teesside, which, of course, was the scene of shipbuilding and coal mining, you know, 100 years ago. And these are the places that are being invested in for carbon capture, for hydrogen production, And also they feed into the supply chain for offshore wind. So by a stroke of fate, actually, a lot of the old industrial areas in the North and Midlands are precisely the areas which are going to be benefiting from investment and from the green industrial revolution.
Just let me take you to Grimsby. You can see what offshore wind is doing for parts of the country outside the southeast. Kwasi, I know you visited, and it's wonderful to go there. Just come and meet the people whose town is being transformed by offshore renewables.
Sir David, the common theme of this podcast, as it's merged, is that we are going to need a combination of new technologies and new energy sources in order to meet our goals of net zero. Do you think the government has been clear enough about how they're going to combine all of those factors together? Do you actually see that pathway yet, or is it still just in principle?
I don't think until the white paper emerges that we can say that we can see the pathway in detail. But nevertheless, I think the intention is very clear, and the intention is completely consistent with the British government's commitment to net zero by 2050. I think the other side of this is that we're in the presidency of COP26 in Glasgow this time next year. And for the British government to be making these statements with clarity ahead of COP26 is absolutely the right thing to do. We know that climate change is going to impact on this country more severely than many others because we are an island nation. Rising sea levels are now the biggest threat from climate change. And as an island nation, we are threatened by that. But can I also say that it really would be important for the government to stress this business of innovation and wealth creation and job creation, because amongst all of our new economic developments, the offshore wind industry in particular, but renewable energy sector, has developed into a big new employer, probably 500,000 people, and it's come at just the right time as the offshore oil and gas industry is becoming thinner because the oil and gas is running out in that region. We find that people are being employed directly into the offshore wind industry. I mean, here's a very important message for the oil and gas companies who didn't get into wind, which is that it's their own marine engineers who moved over into the offshore wind industry and provided the pathway to lower the cost for offshore wind. So I think if we're looking at a future for Britain, we obviously want to look at these issues of employment and wealth creation. And both of these emerge from this whole agenda. It is exactly the right way forward. And my last point on this is every bit of infrastructure investment that takes place anywhere in the world over the coming years, beginning this year, needs to be focused on fitness for the 21st century. And fitness for the 21st century means you're using the phrase going green. And I'm saying in terms of the energy sector, it means not any longer using fossil fuels. We're moving rapidly into the post-fossil fuel era.
Benj, back to you. Your company has a very interesting story that Sir David was almost hinting at. Until recently, you were an oil and gas company. Tell us about that transition.
That's right. So, and just to say, I guess I'm kind of a personification of the journey. I spent 21 years in upstream oil and gas, exploring for and producing oil as a geologist. So I've made the transition 12 years ago. I joined Dong Energy when it was an oil and gas company with a small offshore wind business. Offshore wind was a very nascent technology. And then around 4 years ago, we made the decision that we needed to address the climate emergency. We'd become very proficient at offshore wind. We could see that it was going to be a hugely important technology for Europe and ultimately globally. And that's why we made the very bold decision, I think, at the time, to move completely out of oil and gas. And we've become pure renewables and low carbon energy company. And our mission is to deliver a world that runs entirely on green energy. And we increasingly see that as being achievable on the way to net zero.
It certainly was a bold decision, especially for the time. It can't have hurt to have been one of the first big players in wind energy.
Absolutely. We took that opportunity. We moved into offshore wind 20 plus years ago. In fact, we've just decommissioned our first offshore wind farm, a very, very small one in Denmark. So we've seen the wind farms through their full offshore life cycle. And I think it has given us an advantage. We have a very strong team. We are over 2,000 people in our offshore wind business across the globe. And we are driving innovation very hard to keep the cost coming down, to increase output from our wind farms and make this ever more attractive as a way of decarbonising electricity systems. And by the way, also producing clean air, because many countries around the world are challenged by not only the carbon emissions from their power generation, but also the pollutants. So offshore wind, we've really grabbed that and driven the cost down. And of course, we're not the only players, but I think we have taken a leading role in that because we were the first movers.
Sir David, last question to you. Do you think the public is on board with this drive for a green agenda? It feels like a lot has happened very fast, overnight, some might say, but perhaps people waking up to the green agenda has also been a very fast process.
That's a very difficult question to answer because public opinion swings around so rapidly. I don't think any one of us can say without a more detailed analysis. But to be honest, given the employment produced by the green energy sector, given the need to get to net zero emissions, this isn't just some kind of random desire. The challenges of climate change are with us today, and we need to manage them. I think the arguments are very clear. The argument has already been made that we need to get out to the public much more and explain all of this. We've moved on very substantially in this country and abroad from the era when there were so-called climate skeptics around who were questioning all of these actions. And the reason we've moved on is because the impacts of climate change are with us today. And so I do think this is a winner. It is the only way forward. And taking the public along on this very exciting route and very necessary route is going to be a critical pathway into the future.
Kwasi, David and Benj, thank you so much for joining me on the Spectators podcast. And thanks again to Orsted for sponsoring.